Business and government work together today. Town meeting
meeting is on the air. Welcome to Historic Town Hall and another unrehearsed, uncensored, and thoroughly spontaneous program fashioned after the old New England town meeting. On behalf of the National Broadcasting Company, I take pleasure in presenting our moderator, Mr. George V. Denny, Jr., President of Town Hall. Mr. Denny.
Good evening, neighbors. If the shadow of war clouds the discussion of our domestic problems in these days, it's well for us to remember that if we are to avoid a similar fate to Europe, we must learn to make democracy work within our own national boundaries and resolve our disputes at the conference table where justice rather than force is the criterion. The strife of opinion, say Dr. and Mrs. Overstreet in their book Town Meeting Comes to Town, has nothing in it of the brute fight to overmaster and destroy. Such fighting, having force as its criterion, is the way of barbarism. For in it, the loser only loses. The fight of ideas, on the other hand, is the way of civilization. And in this fight, he who loses, loses to truth, and thereby wins. This kind of fighting is good for everybody. It's in the spirit of highest patriotism that we present our discussion this evening on the subject, Can Business and Government Work Together Today? In this symposium, four distinguished Americans, two businessmen, a United States senator, and a government official are going to contribute their thoughts on ways in which business and government can work together in the common welfare today. Our first speaker is Mr. Floyd Odlum, president of the Atlas Corporation. Our second speaker is the president of the New York Stock Exchange, Mr. William M. Martin, Jr. The distinguished United States Senator from Ohio, the Honorable Robert Taft, will be our third speaker, and we will hear finally from Mr. Jerome Frank, returning to the town hall platform this year in his capacity as Chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. There will be the usual question period for members of our representative audience of more than 1,500 people following these addresses. I now take pleasure in presenting our first speaker, Mr. Floyd Odlum. Mr. Odlum.
I can offer myself as Exhibit A among living examples of regulation of business by government. During the past several years, I have spent almost more time in Washington dealing with government than in the headquarters of the company I serve. In my attempts to steer a business course under conflicting laws, I have developed a strong feeling of sympathy for the chameleon we've all heard about. I refer to the chameleon which was dropped on a piece of Scotch plaid and burst apart trying to be all colors at the same time. I have not burst yet. In fact, I'm so far from bursting that I can answer tonight's question with an emphatic yes. In giving that answer, I don't want to be misunderstood. This has been no picnic period. I've always favored individual initiative, opportunity, and freedom from restraint. For myself, I don't like regulation at any time by anyone. But as a liberal businessman, I also try to be realistic and practical. I realize that regulation is a normal relationship between government and business. I try, therefore, to help make it work smoothly and successfully. My reason for saying that government and business can work together is rooted in my simple philosophy of business. It contains two points. One is that the economic environment of our country is dynamic, not static. The other is that business, to prosper, must accept and adapt itself to changing conditions. Even in my lifetime, business was operated on a very different basis than it is today. This early period has been referred to by some historians as the public be damned period. It has been referred to by some of our living elders as the good old days. Whether they were good or bad, they're gone forever. No so-called reactionaries, however much they may itch to wear the economic crowns of their fathers, can bring those days back. Meanwhile, what is it that characterizes this new era? It is characterized both by technological and social changes. In technology, we have seen the streamlined railroad and airplane conquer distance, while the radio and telephone have annihilated time. On the social side, the aspiration level of the American people has been steadily rising. Both of these changes are good for business. Economically, the only way for the American people to go is upward. Anything that adds to the determination of the American people to go that way is a business asset. To provide this more abundant life is the job of business. All this adds up to mean that the businessman no longer lives unto himself, nor is a law unto himself. It also means that business and government, whether they like it or not, are obliged to draw together in a closer and closer relationship. There can be no dispute as to whether there should be regulation. We can only have a difference of opinion as to degree. On this, there are two extreme schools of thought. One believes there should be no control, that we should return to the so-called good old days. The other believes in complete regimentation of business, even to the point of government ownership and operation. Today's papers report a statement made at last night's Congress of American Industry that America must soon face the issue as between a free, competitive form of economy and government ownership. I don't believe it. Between these extremes lies the ideal, in my opinion. There are those who try to tell us that our administrators in Washington are in the extremist group, desirous of destroying private business operated for profit. I have trod the inquisitorial halls of Washington for 6 years, and I have seen no real evidence that these men are trying either to take the profits out of private business or to take democracy out of government. In this statement, I am naturally not referring to a small, frenzied fringe of fanatics found in government, and let me add, in business also, and by whose declarations nothing can be judged. Government impact on business naturally brings irritation. Furthermore, in the field of regulation, we also have pioneering, and therefore mistakes. This seems to be the American way, but it is also the American way to have an umpire. We may chase the umpire off the field if he seems too partisan or engaged in making rather than enforcing rules. But such passing irritations do not cause us to attack the umpiring system. I'm satisfied that the great bulk of our administrators and regulators today believe that the interests of government and business go hand in hand, that the object of regulation is to help business, and that the proper object of business is to make profits. There has also been growing evidence that regulators realize that to be good business traffic cops, they don't have to, indeed should not, sit in the driver's seat. Their function, rather, is to keep the traffic lights operating, to arrest traffic violators when practical, but above all, to keep the traffic moving as fast as safety permits. The question tonight involves not only the attitude of government toward business, but equally the attitude of business toward government. It is the job of business not only to function under regulation, but to keep regulation functioning. Business on the defensive and openly critical has perhaps made its own road harder than necessary. Business, by an open-minded, friendly, cooperative approach, will find itself invited by government to sit at the conference table while policies are discussed and rules formulated. I know this from experience. Every other businessman can have the same experience. It's important to be so invited, for government must learn from business itself concerning the practical problems of business. The results, I'm sure, will be as welcome to government as to business. The thing that I worry about is not regulation or even the degree thereof. I worry much more about the attacks and counterattacks that have been going on between certain elements in government and certain elements in business these past depression years. The suspicion and fear so created caused capital to go on strike. It is the biggest strike of our lifetime, the most drawn out and the most costly. Some believe it was a lockout rather than a strike. Most of the debatable and irritating questions dealing with government and business have grown out of the efforts of government to get private capital back to work. But capital is scary. It can't be driven. It must be coaxed. Confidence is the best bait. Return of confidence, I believe, can be speeded if, among other things, business and government will declare a moratorium on name-calling and consequent suspicion breeding. Yes, and if reforming and crusading are geared in mesh with business profit accelerators. These beginnings will pay dividends. I would like to say both to business and government, meet a friend.
Mr. Odlum. And now we are to hear from another businessman, Mr. William M. Martin, president of the New York Stock Exchange. Mr. Martin.
I am grateful for the opportunity to take part in this discussion because our entire national welfare depends upon the affirmative answer to the question, can business and government work together today? Present world conditions are such that it is imperative that every citizen do all in his power to make this answer yes. Our government is one established by the consent of the governed, not a government of coercion. There must be something radically wrong indeed when antagonism exists between government and business. Government is not a success unless it is a friend of business. And business cannot exist without the help of government. They must be friends, and they will be friends, if government sticks to government and business sticks to business. Our forefathers who created our Constitution were desperately afraid of government. They came to America because they objected to being told how to worship and what they must do and must not do. And while they knew that government was necessary, at the same time, they also knew from their own bitter experiences that the tendency of government was to take to itself more power at every opportunity. Hence, they created our system of checks and balances. They felt that slow movement was much safer than emergency movement, even though results could be obtained more quickly by emergency measures. Their wisdom is evident from what has happened in Europe in the recent past. It is true that business has at times sought to influence government to its own advantage and to the disadvantage of the public. Thus, conditions sometimes arise where, for the welfare of business itself and the public, it is necessary that regulatory powers be vested in government. This is what brought into being the Securities and Exchange Commission. The New York Stock Exchange has recognized that such a commission performs a useful function, and it has been, and is our desire to cooperate with it fully in the interest of the public. The commission's function, however, is regulating and not operating. It would be asking too much of human nature to expect that men could fashion such an instrument as the Securities Exchange Act and do it in such a way that it would be perfect at the first effort. There is no act that I know of that has ever reached that standard in its original creation. And the reason often is that, as in the case of the Securities and Exchange Commission, there were flagrant derelictions that invited legislation. So great was the emphasis upon these derelictions that the thousands of honest and competent brokers were overlooked. Just how much they were penalized, perhaps unwittingly, could not have been known except from experience. The Securities and Exchange Commission, all of us agree, serves a purpose. But the commissioners themselves must more than once have had doubts in their own minds as to whether some of the provisions of the Act really remedy an evil or work a hardship. The Securities Exchange Act is so new a law that it is certain to contain some defects, and it would seem that the commission, in the interest of the public, would be glad after 5 years of operation to discuss with the exchanges of the country possible revisions in the direction of an improved regulatory law. Any conflict between government and business must be an uneven one, because government always has the advantage. But it is the public, remember, which suffers most in such a conflict. Therefore, no greater service can be rendered to the American people than to have groups such as the Town Hall of the Air discuss these questions openly and freely. My purpose in the few minutes at my disposal is to get across a viewpoint rather than to argue political or business science. During the last 7 years, many new laws regulating business have been passed. This was in accord with changing times and conditions. Dishonest bankers, dishonest utility magnates, and dishonest brokers had undermined the confidence of people in business. But I seriously question whether there is an informed man or woman in this audience who really believes these isolated examples were representative. The record shows that government has had its share of dishonest men and has made its share of mistakes. Let me take this opportunity to say, as president of the New York Stock Exchange, that I take great pride in my present associates. I would have no hesitation in matching the men of my community with those of any other, and that includes government, when it comes to the desire to do right and promote the public welfare. The present management of the exchange has accepted the Securities Exchange Act as the law of the land. It has made every effort to improve its organization and its services. It has undergone a complete reorganization and has added so many additional rules in the interest of the public that it is difficult for even those in our business to be readily familiar with all of them. Study is being made of the possibility of other improvements, but it would seem the part of wisdom for the Securities and Exchange Commission in administering the law to credit the exchange with good faith and not to take the position that honest brokers must be burdened with experimental restrictions which may or may not be in the public interest. The securities business badly needs an opportunity to catch its breath. The morale of those in our business is low. The efficiency of our market, which is essential to American business, is threatened. We have the right to expect our government to cooperate with us to preserve our market, to help us keep the house from burning down, and not to heap fuel on the flames. If we are to continue to have an efficient and serviceable market, and this is vital to the country, it is imperative for us and for government itself to give more attention to ways and means of properly maintaining our operations. I would be less than honest if I did not make these observations at this time. The opportunity exists in the relations between the New York Stock Exchange and the Securities and Exchange Commission for a practical test of the ability of business and government to work together constructively. In conclusion, I would like to say that in my judgment, the greatest impediment to the successful cooperation of business and government today lies in the wide area of discretionary power vested in administrators. I recognize that emergencies sometimes arise which require unusual methods, but government by law is always superior to government by men, and it is important for us to remember that under the demands of war emergencies. Government and business can work together if government by consent is not permitted to become government by coercion. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Now I take pleasure in presenting our third speaker, distinguished United States Senator from the state of Ohio, the Honorable Robert Taft. Mr. Taft.
Ladies and gentlemen, the title assigned this evening sounds much simpler than it is. It attempts to personify business and personify government as if each were one person. This is more true of the government than of business. But business is not an individual and cannot speak with one voice. It is too customary for the press and the people to regard business as big business, whereas its views and interests often are entirely different from those of the small businessman who is the average businessman. Furthermore, large business is in a small minority. There are over 1,600,000 independent retail businesses, 176,000 independent wholesale businesses, and nearly 170,000 independent manufacturing establishments, of which 98% employ less than 500 men. So it is a great mistake to put too much reliance on the views of some individual big businessman. On the whole, I would say he is more likely to be friendly to the government, or at least more anxious to be thought to be, than the small businessman. The title assigned this evening also assumes the unsound premise that this imaginary individual known as business is on an equality with government and can in some way cooperate in a grand effort to all boost together. It implies that businessmen share the blame for the enmity which does exist among them today against the present government. But the average businessman cannot have the slightest influence on the government's actions. He has to obey the laws and regulations and does so. He has a hard enough time keeping his own head above water. He is seldom in a position to hurt anybody, least of all his own employees, if he is completely let alone by the government. On the other hand, the government can have a tremendous effect on him. Regulations which big business can perhaps conform to are likely to destroy the business or at least the profits of the average businessman. The relation between government and business depends more than 80% on the attitude of the government, and less than 20% on the attitude of business, probably less than 5% on the attitude of the average small businessman. If the question of the evening is purely abstract, of course business and government could work together. They always have before 1936 under both Republican and Democratic administrations. There can't be much doubt that business and government ought to be friends. But if the question is not abstract, but relates to the present government, as it is, with its present philosophy, the answer, in my opinion, is no. I have traveled quite extensively through a number of states and intensively through the state of Ohio. I should say that 4/5 of the businessmen, large and small, are against the present administration. It is hard to work together. (Clears throat) It is hard to work together with someone who is unfriendly to you, and the truth is that the present administration, however it may talk of breathing spells and business appeasement, is not in the last analysis friendly to the growth and development of private enterprise. There are a great many individuals in the government in Washington who are entirely opposed to the profit system. Government is certainly not friendly to business when it goes into business itself, as in the TVA and many other enterprises in competition with existing businesses. For it is absolutely impossible for any individual business to compete successfully with the government. Government is not friendly to business if, by taxes like the undistributed profits tax, it deliberately attempts to prevent the saving of money by corporate enterprises and the reinvestment of that money in the extension of plant to build small enterprises into large. Secondly, business is unfriendly to government today because it thoroughly disapproves of some government policies which the government perhaps intends to be friendly and helpful to business. The great bulk of American businessmen are convinced that the currency manipulation, for instance, is dangerous to business. Certainly, businessmen don't understand the government's insistence on retaining the emergency power to devalue the dollar further and issue $3 billion of greenbacks. Businessmen today have come to oppose the whole principle of regulating prices and wages, begun in the NRA and carried through by numerous additional agencies since the NRA was declared unconstitutional. Today it has become apparent that the government can't fix the price of basic commodities in one industry without fixing them in all, and cannot fix prices of basic commodities at all unless it is prepared to fix wages and practices and every detail of operation. Businessmen of today distrust this government policy because they realize that in the end it is absolutely destructive of the entire business system of individual enterprise and of adequate rewards for thrift, industry, and ability, the system which has made America what it is. They can't work together with a government which talks of business appeasement but is still animated by a strong leaning to planned economy. Businessmen consider it impossible to work with a government which still believes that a people can spend itself into prosperity and adds $10 million every day to the public debt, which businessmen will have to pay off sooner or later. They certainly wouldn't work with another businessman headed for the bankruptcy court, and they hesitate to work with a government headed in the same direction. There are other government policies which business approves in principle, but where the administration is so unfriendly on the government side as to remove all friendliness on the business side. The National Labor Relations Act, intended to assure the right of collective bargaining, has been administered in a most unfriendly way by a board of whom one is a communist sympathizer, and all inspired by a crusading spirit. Inspired by a crusading spirit not only against employers, but against the older established unions. The Securities and Exchange Commission seems to have gone beyond its wise purpose of preventing fraud in the sale of securities to hamper seriously the distribution of new securities by regulations, restrictions, and red tape. And so today. And so today I think we must say that business and the present government are not friends, and that they are not friends simply because the government's policies have been either deliberately unfriendly to private enterprise or so burdensome and restrictive as to check the normal conduct of business by those millions of Americans who make the wheels of our country go round. Undoubtedly there is fault on the side of business, though I would say that the number of businessmen who oppose a reasonable government restraint are few and far between today. Undoubtedly, there must be government regulation to prevent monopolistic practices and to prevent competitive methods which drive out of business those who deserve to succeed. The speakers were asked tonight to present an affirmative and constructive answer to the question of the evening. I would say that if business and government are to work together, the government must change the basic principles of its present policies, or the people must change the government.
We pause now for station identification.
WJZ, New York.
Thank you, Senator Taft. Now, continuing our program, I have the honor to present our fourth speaker, Mr. Jerome Frank, Chairman of the Securities Exchange Commission. Mr. Frank.
We often say, and correctly, that we have a government of laws and not of men. We don't mean that our government is a piece of automatic, non-human machinery. We mean that we have a government of laws made by men in Congress, construed by men on the courts, and administered by men in government agencies. Tonight, I am not talking of the work of the men in Congress, nor of the wisdom of the laws they enact, for I was not supposed to. Nor am I talking of the decisions of judges. I am talking solely of the conduct of government men who administer existing laws, administer them always within the limits set by the legislature and subject to review by the courts. The question being asked tonight is whether such government men can cooperate with businessmen. Before proceeding, let me say that when I accepted the invitation to speak here tonight, I did not realize that I was to be on the program with an avowed and distinguished candidate for a presidential nomination. And one who has already begun his campaign for office, as you may have observed this evening. I am a member of a non-political commission required by statute. The commission is required by law to consist of not more than three members of the same political party, and two of my colleagues are Republicans. They are not New Dealers. If we work together, it is because we are reasonable men and find it possible to do so. In the circumstances, it would hardly be proper for me, indeed Senator Taft might invoke the Hatch Act if I were to do so, to meet the senator in a political debate in the beginning of a presidential campaign. I shall confine myself, therefore, to what I have from the first understood, and I thought that Senator Taft had understood, to be the question of the evening. Not the policies or wisdom of legislation, but the question, can government administrators and businessmen work together? When I answer that question, I feel like the farmer who was asked whether he believed in baptism. He replied, "Believe in it? Gosh, I've seen it. For I see every day, and often on nights, Sundays, and holidays, in Washington and elsewhere, government officers actively and effectively cooperating with businessmen. I would bore you if I were merely to recite a complete list of the various agencies of the federal government constantly engaged in such cooperation. To take some samples, you imagine that the RFC doesn't cooperate with business, or the Civil Aeronautics Authority with aviation, or Federal Housing with builders and bankers? And what of the Federal Reserve Board, the Federal Deposit Insurance Company, the Bureau of Standards, the Maritime Commission, the Post Office, the Forestry Service, the Bureau of Mines? Do you imagine? Do you imagine in all seriousness that a day goes by, or even an hour, when these and many other agencies are not working for and cooperating with business? But tonight I want to talk what I know about. I want to talk of my own recent experiences in government. I wish I could show you a talking motion picture of life at the SEC. If I did, you would see a daily example of untiring efforts, as Mr. Odlum well knows, to find workable solutions for difficult problems of business adjustment to existing law. Why do we make those efforts? Because our laws affect hundreds of businessmen with as many differing business problems, and because those laws, being new, have imposed novel standards of conduct which may be a shock to established customs and habits. Plain horse sense dictates that in administering such new legislation, a governmental official must be patient. What form does that patience take? When Congress directs an agency like the SEC to draft rules and regulations, the agency can do one of two things. It can, and quite lawfully, follow what was once considered the normal governmental method. Without consulting any outsiders, the business affected, or anybody else, it can simply adopt its rules and announce them. Or instead, it can first call in representatives of those who are to be affected by the rules and say, Congress told us that we must promulgate rules on this subject. That is our duty. But we want your ideas on the mechanics. We want our rules to be workable, and we want them to accomplish the objectives of Congress with as little business disturbance as possible. That might be called the patient or cooperative method. And that is our method. We've used that method of consultation, informal and not proctoted, with respect to virtually every important rule we've promulgated. And the assistance we've received from business has been of inestimable value. There are many other examples of cooperation. For instance, I suppose that as much of the time of our legal staff is devoted to giving counsel to businessmen as to us. Daily, we receive letters from businessmen and their lawyers thanking us for that kind of cooperation. I have in my files such a letter received early this year from a member of Senator Taft's own law firm. Sitting behind my government desk, I see two notably different types of businessmen. They might be called Mr. Will and Mr. Won't. Mr. Will is a realist. He recognizes that while a law is on the books, he must work under it. So he comes to us and says, my sole desire is to adjust my business to the law as quickly as possible so that I can save time and make money for my stockholders. Here's what I want to do. Can I do it under the law? And if so, how? What happens? He discovers that Congress has set the standards to be complied with, but has often left a considerable latitude as to method. He sits down with the government experts. They and he between them try to find out which of the methods is best suited to his particular problem. Method, mind you, not of evasion or nullification of the law, but of compliance. In those conferences, Mr. Will often convinces the government men of the practicability of a method within the law, which they had not discovered, and Mr. Odlum and I say, as he himself said, is Exhibit A. To have a hard-headed, conscientious businessman like Floyd Odlum thus present the realities of his concrete business problems must broaden the understanding of government administrators. And the successful solution of those business problems is an exciting experience for us and the businessman. It is creative. By demonstrating the law's workability, it converts the law from a mere assemblage of dead letters on a page into a human, living institution. But what of Mr. Won't? Mr. Won't is a man who, for personal or business reasons, doesn't like the law and won't comply. Now, any man has a right, in speech, print, or in the courts, to oppose or criticize any law or the administration of any law. That's basic democracy. But as an administrator of law and as a lawyer and as a believer in law and order, I can see no reason why a businessman who defies a law should not be regarded as a lawbreaker. Our government provides an orderly process for the review, repeal, or amendment of laws, but it doesn't authorize the violation of existing law. There are some Mr. Won'ts who take us into court to challenge the law or our administration of the law. That is their unquestioned right. To hear such grievances is what the courts are for, and we are for the courts. But there's another kind of Mr. Won't. He wears a false face, disguising himself as a Mr. Will. He might be called Mr. Pretend I Will. He has a pleasant smile, a gracious manner, a smooth tongue, and not the slightest intention of doing anything. His policy is to stall. He is praying that somehow there will be a repeal of the law before we get around to applying it to him. To transform Mr. Pretend I Will from a sham or fake Mr. Will into a real Mr. Will is a hope which induces us to spend much time with him. Usually we fail. Then we must take him into court to make him comply with the law. That is essential. For if Mr. Will and Mr. Pretend I Will are competitors, it is unfair to allow Mr. Pretend to get away with it indefinitely with noncompliance. And then when we finally do try to carry out the express will of Congress, Mr. Pretend takes to name-calling and charges us with cracking down on his entire industry and undermining business confidence. There is one paramount reason why government officers in the SEC believe in cooperation between business and government. Congress would never have passed the SEC laws if it had wanted to do away with the profit system. Instead, it would have tried to use dictatorial confiscation and other drastic methods applied in Russia and Germany. The SEC laws were expressly designed to restore and maintain good faith between the corporation and investors. Without that good faith, the profit system would crack up and democracy would be imperiled. We in the SEC are therefore engaged in the task of fortifying the American profit system in the interest of democracy. We, and enlightened, far-seeing businessmen, can have no other objective. Our aim is and must be this: a secure profit system under a secure democracy. And cooperation between government and business can achieve and is achieving that result, an indispensable result, if America is to avert the alternative disaster of chaos or tyranny.
Are we ready for the question period? The members of the audience who have questions, please rise and state the name of the person to whom that question is directed.
In view of the presentation here tonight of yourself and the other speaker, I would like to know your definition of a liberal.
I suppose that's on the subject, since you call yourself a liberal businessman, Mr. Odlum. Fire away.
Well, the term liberal is something like the old circus tent. It can cover a lot of territory. It's very elastic. Certainly, liberality, in my opinion, has nothing to do with giving away other people's money. I don't think it has anything to do with the change of the form of a democratic government. There was a poll about a year or two ago by one of our national magazines on the subject of business and government, which dealt with this term liberal. And I think the consensus of opinion from that poll was that a liberal is one who stops short of interfering with the profits of business. I think that a reactionary can be defined as one who thinks that anything this side of the old square dance is bad. I think a conservative can be defined as one who is willing to toy with the idea of dancing the old-fashioned waltz occasionally. I think a liberal is willing to try the modern steps. Of course, I'm referring to the dancing by all three of them on the same dance floor. The radical wants to do his dancing out on the sidewalk. A friend of mine defined a liberal businessman for me only yesterday as one who takes account of changing circumstances and tries to adapt himself to them. So far as I'm concerned, I'd like to take that as my definition of a liberal.
Mr. Martin, do you want to define a liberal and a conservative here tonight?
I'm neither one.
I thought I ought to give another businessman a chance anyway.
I pose as an independent. I don't think a
I don't think a liberal is a man who thinks that everything the government does is right and who fails to stand upon the rights defined by the law that gives in to the desires of government at every point. I think a conservative is a man who realizes that the things that have been tried in the past probably had some reason, and they ought to be thought of very carefully before they're discarded for mere chance thinking.
And the ballot.
I should like to ask whether the senator thinks that government and business would be better friends under a Republican administration.
I don't think that the party label makes very much difference, no. Seems to me that the...
Thank you, sir. Mr. Adler. Mr. Adler.
I'd like to ask if you believe that the founders of our government expected that we would have regulation as it is today.
That's a rather speculative question. All right, Mr. Adler, go ahead and comment on it.
Well,
you can just say yes or no.
I think if the founders of our government had had vision enough to foresee the complications of modern business life, they would have foreseen regulation as we have it today, because the two go together. Unfortunately, the founders made our system elastic enough to take care of it.
Thank you. The young lady in the aisle. Mr. Frank.
Suppose a small businessman is a Mr. Will he get a hearing with the government? Or if a Mr. Won't, will his grievance get to court?
Well, there are two hypothetical cases, but your will and won't are hypothetical, so you better answer that, Mr. Frank.
I want to say that as far as I'm concerned, I want to do and have done everything possible so that Mr. Will, if he's a small businessman, will be accorded precisely the same treatment as a big businessman. And if he's a Mr. Won't and wants to go into court, he'll have precisely the same rights as if he were a big businessman.
The last throw in the ballot.
None of the past.
The last throw in the ballot.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Mr. Martin.
The stock exchange has taken the steps that it has taken since the Depression to clean its own house if it had not been for the legislation taken in Washington.
I don't think it would have taken all of them. But I think it would have taken some of them. The exchange was very unfortunate in having a very unfortunate case, the Whitney case. That case, as I've tried to outline, was an exceptional case, and I think you gentlemen know it. The exchange since that time has been reorganized. It's done everything in its power to meet the law, but it doesn't intend to give up its rights completely.
Don't you think it's better to tolerate the SEC, even though it can certainly be improved, than to allow ourselves to go back to the wild days responsible for 1929 and what followed?
I've always been in favor of the SEC. I only suggested that the act was administered in a way that seemed to be unduly unfriendly to the progress of private enterprise in the flotation of new securities.
Senator Taft spoke disparagingly of the planned economy. I'm wondering, in the state of Ohio, with the Toledo schools closed for 7 weeks, with tens of thousands hungry in Cleveland, not starving, but hungry, wouldn't some kind of a planned economy be a good thing in the state of Ohio?
No, I think the state of Ohio is well able to take care of itself. Its citizens are not starving. A fight is going on. Absolutely not. A local fight is going on between some sections of the state and two counties in the state. The rest of the state taking the position that it's up to those two counties to look after their own affairs, and if they manage their business properly, they could do so. Those two counties maintain they can't. But as far as any starvation is concerned, I think you'll find that there isn't any such difficulty. Incidentally, as far as the schools in Toledo are concerned, is due entirely to the fact that the people of Toledo deliberately voted down a proposed extra levy for those schools. That's local self-government. If they don't want schools, that's their affair, it seems to me. As a matter of fact, it's... I believe very strongly in local self-government. I think every city ought to determine what kind of schools it wants and what kind of education it's going to give its children.
Frank,
in view of Mr. Martin's statement that the security business is badly in need of a breathing spell and that the morale of those in that business is low, why doesn't the SEC do something to help the brokerage business?
Why doesn't the SEC do something to give the brokerage business a breathing spell, Mr. Frank?
The SEC, since I have been on it, has promulgated virtually no rules of importance affecting the stock exchange. For the past 2 years, the SEC has been saying to the stock exchange, instead of our using our regulations, we suggest with respect to greater customer protection against possible insolvencies, since the exchange is the largest unregulated bank of deposit in the world, with no bank examination by federal bank examiners, something we wouldn't think of tolerating with respect to any other bank, we have suggested to them that they should do something about it on their own. A few months ago, Mr. Martin appointed a committee of his own choosing of distinguished businessmen and lawyers. They brought in a report making recommendations, but one of those recommendations has been adopted to date. The SEC is waiting patiently, it has made no comments of any kind, to see what is going to be done about those recommendations. I hear mutterings against them. We are not responsible for those recommendations, nor can I say on behalf of the Commission authoritatively that we would approve of all of them if adopted and consider them a substitute, but I have a fairly sneaking notion about what our statement would be. We have not introduced such regulations. As to discretion, let me say to Mr. Martin that when the Securities Exchange Commission was being set up, the report of the Congressional Committee on the Statute said, representatives of the stock exchange constantly urged a greater degree of flexibility in the statute, I'm quoting, and insisted that the complicated nature of the problems justified leaving much greater latitude of discretion with the administrative agencies than would otherwise be the case. And it was for that reason the bill was so drafted. Now, as to the stock exchange, the total sales on all stock exchanges in the year 1938, which would probably turn out not to be as good as 39, were approximately $14 billion. This was 14 times the volume of mail order sales. It was over four times the size of all building contracts. It was four times the railway operating revenues. It was seven times the volume of sales of electric power. Now, I don't know why the exchange can't make money on that volume of business. We are eager that they should, provided the investors are protected. We are not willing that they should and go back to the rinky-dink and gambling of the days prior to the passage of the statute.
Mr. Martin, will you comment on what Mr. Frank has just said?
I'm surprised that Mr. Frank thinks we haven't adopted any regulations recently. I don't know where he's been. Perhaps his legal staff has been too busy thinking up ways of changing the present law. I think that one failing with Mr. Frank, and I say this in all kindness and not meant in any way in a derogatory sense to Mr. Frank, is the fact that he's never faced the problem of soliciting business. He's never known what it is to have to go out and try to get a customer. He's never known how hard it is to earn a living in that sense. There are any number of brokers, any number of competent individuals that in a market where there are more shares listed today than there were in 1929 and has had a turnover so slight that despite the fact that people say there hasn't been adequate contraction in the brokerage business, the number of employees is down over 4,000 registered representatives in the last 4 years. The amount of capital, the business is not overcapitalized. The amount of capital has declined consistently, and the difficulty today is getting capital to go into the business. And what we need today is a realization of the fact that there is no manipulation to speak of. There are no operators. I say that honestly because there will always be a little bit of manipulation until the SEC defines manipulation. And what we need today more than anything else is for all of us to take a constructive attitude and realize that people have to make a living in this country as well as have to live under regulation.
I want to say that I agree with Mr. Martin that the amount of manipulation on the stock exchange is not great, I'm happy to say. I want to say also that I did not mean to indicate that the exchange had not adopted regulations. What I did mean to say was that we are patiently waiting without criticism, nor have we criticized, to see what they do with their own committee's report that was issued September 1st. We're very much interested. We are not doing anything to coerce them. We haven't criticized them. We're waiting patiently.
Thank you very much, Mr. Frank. And all the other speakers on this program, I want to thank you for your enlightening help. I also want to thank and express my deep appreciation to one of our most active and useful trustees who helped us in arranging this program, Mrs. Richard C. Patterson, Jr. Mrs. Patterson is a sort of godmother to the town meeting of the air because she was the first woman on our board to whom I talked about this plan, and she took it to her husband, who was then the executive vice president of NBC, and he referred it to Mr. John Royal, and Mr. Royal and his associates took it up, and we've been carrying on happily ever since. Now, following the closing of our essay contest last week, we have an important new contest to announce before we tell you about next week's program. Town Hall, in cooperation with Liberty Magazine, is offering $1,800 in cash prizes for the best cartoon or drawings on the subject. How can the town meeting idea best preserve American democracy and liberty? Anyone can compete except employees of the Town Hall and McFadden Publications and members of their families. Cartoons must be approximately 14 by 16 inches and should be drawn on white Bristol board in India ink, pencil, or charcoal. Cartoons will be judged for aptness, originality, power, simplicity, and draftsmanship. The best entry will receive a cash prize of $1,000, first prize. The second best will receive a prize of $300, and five entries next in order of excellence will receive cash prizes of $100 each. In the event of ties, duplicate awards will be made. The prize-winning cartoons will become the property of America's Town Meeting of the Air, and entries should be addressed to the Town Hall, 123 West 43rd Street. They must be postmarked on or before February 21st, 1940, the closing date of the contest. More complete announcement about the contest can be obtained in this week's Liberty Magazine. And information about the Town Hall and the Town Meeting idea can be obtained by writing the Town Hall or the NBC station to which you are listening. And now, Mr. Cross, for those who want copies of tonight's program.
The complete transcription of tonight's program is published in bulletin form by the Columbia University Press. Each of these programs can be obtained at a nominal charge of 10 cents, or if you would like the entire series of 26 broadcasts, they can be subscribed for now and received weekly at a cost of $2.50. If you want copies of these bulletins, or if you're interested in organizing a town meeting discussion group in your community, address the Town Hall, 123 West 43rd Street, New York
City. And next week's program, Mr. Cross?
Next week at this hour, the subject for discussion will be America and Japan, Embargo or New Treaty.
And the speakers?
The speakers next week will be Rear Admiral Harry E. Yarnell, formerly Commander-in-Chief of the Asiatic Fleet and recently returned to the United States, Dr. Walter H. Judd, who has spent many years in China as head of a large missionary hospital in Shanxi Province, and William R. Castle, formerly ambassador to Japan and later undersecretary of state.
America and Japan. treaty. Town meeting.
This is a Blue Network presentation of the National Broadcasting Company.